Hello, I'm Kate Chabot. Welcome to an extra edition of the Sit Rep podcast. British war poetry has a long and distinguished history. The likes of Siegfried Sassoon, Wilfred Owen and Robert Graves composed some of the most iconic and visceral accounts of the First World War. The hospital where all three met recently hosted the launch of a new book of war poetry. Frontlines and Lifelines was written by Major General Tim Hodgetts throughout most of his 41-year military career. But he had a very particular perspective as a military doctor who rose to become Surgeon General, a post he's just retired from.
A doctor or a soldier first? A common ask by those unversed in risks they cannot understand, nor visualise like glove on hand, sits medicine on soldiering. For in dilemma floundering, young doctors in a firefight choose between their oath or life to lose, while Red Cross armbands have become a target for the sniper's gun.
Major General Tim Hodgetts, welcome to Sit Rep. Thank you for your time. That poem there, that speaks pretty clearly for itself. When did you write it?
So I wrote that particular poem in Afghanistan in 2007. And indeed, many of the poems that I've written have been written in near real time as a means of reflecting on a difficult situation that I've been in.
And that question, doctor or soldier, who do you tend to get that question from? Is it the medical community, military, unconnected civilians, or is it a bit of all of them, or one perhaps you must ask yourself?
I think all of what you've stated there, I've asked it of myself. But yes, it is a question that I am asked relatively frequently, perhaps by people not in the military. But the answer is, of course, it depends. Because if I'm in a situation where I'm being shot at, then I am entitled to defend myself. But as soon as you put a patient in front of me, then I will become laser focused on that individual, and I will be reliant on others around me to provide that protection.
And we'll talk more about the poetry in a bit, but it's very much inspired by your 41-year career in the army. That must have given you a huge range of experiences to draw upon.
It has, and I sometimes think that disaster has followed me around, or perhaps I've sought out disaster in my career. So yes, I've had some very challenging experiences from very early on. Even as a junior doctor in Germany in the late 1980s, I was confronted with terrorism. There were two car bombs in the adjacent street to where we lived, drive-by shootings at the military hospitals, of course, the shootings at Channel ports, and also bombs in other parts of Germany where British soldiers were stationed. So I was thinking very heavily about what I would do if I was confronted with a situation of multiple casualties, particularly with a bombing. And indeed, I wrote my first book as a junior doctor. I remember on a £30 Boots typewriter, I did my my first book, and even did my own drawings for that. But it turned out to be extremely prudent thinking. Because in 1991, I was in Belfast as a middle grade doctor when the IRA blew up the hospital. And although I wasn't the senior rank, I was actually the most qualified. I'd done the exams about pre-hospital emergency care. I'd done that thinking. I'd published about what you would do in a multiple casualty incident. So I did take charge as the medical commander. And for me, that was a day that changed my life because it completely changed my career direction.
When did the poetry writing actually start then? I mean, you have so many experiences to draw upon.
Well, I probably started poetry writing in the early 1990s. Initially, I wrote some rhythms for rhyme, which were very simple four-line poems to help you remember what to do if you are confronted with a cardiac arrest. So ventricular fibrillation, the squiggly line on your electrocardiogram, your heart tracing, that was 200, 200, 360 then, tube, IV, adrenaline, 3 minutes CPR, and then 360 thrice and round again. And I wrote little rhymes that would help me, but of course, they would also help others. So they were published in a medical journal. And then after that, I migrated, I think, towards poetry as a means of helping me reflect the various morally injurious events, the traumatic events that I was serially exposed to.
It's interesting that you said that you felt that disaster has followed you around in your career, but in your job, I mean, as a director of field hospitals, at least six times, I mean, it's bound to happen, isn't it?
It certainly is. And when you're in a field hospital that has very finite resources, in terms of people, in terms of the equipment that you carry, then a relatively small burst of casualties can tip you into what we call a major incident mode, where you need to draw everybody in, all the off-duty staff, and it's regarded as that sort of an extraordinary event. In the civilian setting, where the hospitals are much bigger and there's more ability to absorb a burst in casualties, then you less frequently tip into that major incident mode. But the principles are the same, and the principles that I designed and wrote a course for after that experience in Northern Ireland are absolutely applicable in the civil or the military environment, and in any country. And indeed, it has become the standard around the world for both civil and military practitioners what to do in a major incident.
And how was it working in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, these are some of the most challenging places that I have been to work, but also from a medical perspective, some of the most rewarding, because it was the experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan that drove us to develop the combat casualty care practices. And indeed, I can prove a revolution in combat casualty care in the first 10 years of this century. And indeed, I've published a thesis on it that you can find online if you're interested in reading. But medicine advances in war. We know this. If you go back to Napoleonic times, the first use of medics on the battlefield, the first use of an ambulance volant, a flying ambulance, a horse and cart that would go onto the battlefield, pick up the injured, and take them to Baron Dominique Jean Larrey's treatment facility. He was Napoleon's surgeon marshal. But every major conflict in the last couple of hundred years, you can see where medicine advances. The First World War, the Second World War, and of course, more recently, the Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns have shown this stepwise change and is able to produce a cohort of patients who would never have survived in any previous conflict.
Yeah, you said that it was those deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan were among the most rewarding, but also the most challenging. What made them so challenging?
Well, it was partly the intensity of the number of casualties, the sheer volume that you're working 7 days a week, 16 hours a day, and when you go to bed, you're out of bed again to treat the next injured casualty. So, a very intense clinical experience. Also, the physical threat. When I was the doctor on the helicopter, then you would be flying forward into the poppy field. You'd be being strafed by machine gun fire, mortars walking to your position as you run out the back to find the patients, throw them onto the helicopter, and take off, as the poem says, as if you're on a giant bungee, because you only spend a couple of minutes on the ground, because the medical helicopter, was target number one.
And you have just retired from the post of Surgeon General, a well-known title to many people, but most of us probably don't understand what exactly that job involves. Can you explain it?
So the Surgeon General is the functional leader for defence medicine, so the senior clinical authority on all medical aspects. So whether that's medical policy, guidelines, any difficult medical issues will ultimately end up on the Surgeon General's desk for arbitration.
Yes, and how did you enjoy that job?
Fabulous. I mean, it was a great culmination to my career. It gives you extraordinary access to senior leadership and to your international colleagues. And in parallel, as Surgeon General, I was elected to be the chair of the Committee of Military Medical Chiefs in NATO. So I have been the senior medical advisor in NATO in parallel to being Surgeon General for the last 3 years.
And as your job as Surgeon General, what can you do in that role that helps ordinary servicemen and women?
So I'm an emergency physician by training. So I did 25 years of working in emergency departments in the deployed setting, but also in the peacetime setting within the NHS. So I would be treating individual patients. But as I've risen through the leadership roles, such as medical director for defence, as the head of the Army Medical Services, and then latterly as Surgeon General, I still regard everything I do as clinically focused. It's just doing it on a grander scale. So rather than thinking how you are improving the outcome of an individual patient, you're thinking about how you're improving the outcome of a group of patients. Because underneath the Surgeon General sits the pillar for research and innovation. So we are driving the research, driving up the standards, changing the guidelines constantly to seek better and better outcomes.
No wonder you found it rewarding. I'm just wondering what the challenges, as you see them, are facing military medical personnel right now and the big questions for them going forward.
Well, this is something I've deeply thought of, not only as Surgeon General at a national level, but as the chair of what we call COMEDS, the committee of the Surgeon Generals internationally. And indeed, we, I think, have never had our collective medical risk as well understood as we have it now. It is fully understood by the seniors in defence, and it's fully understood by all nations. And indeed, we took a medical manifesto to the latest NATO summit, where we had identified the broad risks of military medicine as we look to the future into five areas, but with an action plan.
And when you think about the innovations that you've seen in your time, what stands out the most to you?
Well, this is a really good question. And I've analysed this in detail. I can show you. I'll show you a great slideshow with what makes the greatest difference. You could say, was it the tourniquets? Was it the topical hemostatics? Was it the massive transfusion protocols that were brought in? But actually, I would put it down to the data. We collected exquisite data from point of wounding all the way through to rehabilitation. I set the system for that up in 1997. I started it in Frimley Park in an NHS hospital where military staff work. And then I turned that into the system that we use to collect data on operations. And it was that aggressive scrutiny of the detail of every seriously injured or fatally wounded soldier and learning from every single individual that drove us week on week to improve. So it was the fact that we were able to demonstrate which individual changes, whether it was a change to equipment or training, was really making a difference. And we then found ourselves pushing against an open door. Because if you can tell your leaders, if you can tell the politicians that, look, we are doing well, but we could do better with a little bit more investment, then people were very happy to support because you could provide the evidence of change.
Well, let's just now return to your poetry and hear another excerpt from your book.
1 second on, 1 second off, the vehicle horn was sounding. Shot from my sleep, I held my breath. Eyes screwed shut, my heart was pounding. Under the camp bed cot I groped, shadow friends in green bags flailing. The rubber straps were where I'd hoped. Gus, 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 I screamed, exhaling.
Tim, what is the story of that one, the story behind it? Is it based on personal experience?
Yes, absolutely. That was us in Q8. I was with 2-2 Field Hospital initially, which was the first hospital into Q8 to set up close to the Iraq border while we were in the concentration phase when 44,000 troops were deploying out to the Middle East to prepare for war. We were being scudded. And at that time, we were concerned that those missiles might have chemical warheads. Of course, later that was disproved. But at the time, that's what we genuinely believed. So we had dug trenches. And we would run out of those trenches in the middle of the night with the chemical alarm jump in to take cover.
And apart from drawing from personal experience, you're clearly inspired by the first World War poets. And of course, so much of that work is written in a medical setting when they were in hospital too.
That's right. So the sort of household poets' names, Wilfred Owen, Siegfried Sassoon, Robert Graves. They were all patients at a shell shock hospital in Edinburgh on a site called Craig Lockhart. And indeed, that is the site where I launched the book, Frontlines and Lifelines, with the royalties going to the Poppy Factory at the Edinburgh Fringe as part of Forces at the Fringe. And it was a fabulous event because we included all parts of the military. We had the Edinburgh Military Wives Choir. We had a primary school choir from Collinton School, where over half of the children are from military families. We had a vulnerable, brave veteran doing a solo. And we had a chief executive of a sort of a military-related charity, who's also an opera singer, also singing one of the poems, because I'd had four of them set to original music, which had been composed by an Australian Defence Force reservist. So we were hitting all the numbers there.
Every box ticked there. What was it actually like, though, to have your book launched at that very hospital where Sassoon, Owen and Graves all met?
Deeply meaningful. And I did have six actors to support me as well in reading some of the poems, because although I can read the book, when I actually start to vocalise some of these, I you know, they are very strongly emotional for me. These are personal memories. And I wrote them without any intention of sharing them. I wrote them as a means of me reflecting on difficult situations. So reading about COVID and the death of my parents in COVID is better for someone else to do out loud than perhaps me to do.
Sorry to hear about your loss. How does it feel, though, now that you've put those thoughts on paper and they're out in the open for everyone else to see?
Well, I hope some people will get value from them. Of course, there'll be a lot who empathise, because a lot of people deployed, a lot of people have had similar but not exactly the same experiences. They may look at similar situations in a different way. There's a bit of dark humour in there, so it might bring a smile to the face, but it will certainly bring a tear to some people's eyes, because there are some almost unimaginable situations which are expressed within the poems. But also, I hope there may be a little bit of inspiration too, that people can see how you can use this sort of art form to stay resilient, even though you are exposed to these serially injurious events.
So what is next for you?
Well, I'd like to say taking the foot off the pedal a little, but that doesn't seem to be what's actually happening. What I am passionate about in the sort of my next phase is legacy. So I've written a lot of books. I mean, this poetry book's my 37th book. I've published a lot of papers over the years. I love to teach, and I've designed a lot of courses. So I will be teaching, and I've already started teaching within medical schools and business schools, because I think the principles that I've developed for medical leadership, or the experience I've had for medical leadership, is entirely transferable to other sectors. It's just with medical examples, but the principles are absolutely the same. And it is something that I will increasingly write about, and hopefully a couple more books to follow, but on slightly different topics. But I'm also a deputy lieutenant for the County of West Midlands, which is a hugely joyous role. And we pretty much settled in the West Midlands, having been here since we set up the Royal Centre for Defence Medicine in 2001. Trustee of three charities.
You certainly have a lot to be getting on with. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Major General Tim Hodgetts, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
News, discussions, and analysis. This is SITREP.